Welcome to Off Center, the podcast about digital narrative and algorithmic narrativity. My name is Scott Rettberg, and I'm the director of the Center for Digital Narrative at the University of Bergen. In this podcast, I'll have conversations with the researchers at the center, as well as other experts in the field, to discuss topics revolving around digital storytelling and its impact on contemporary culture. How has the internet changed the way that we write, our styles and subject matters? And what does it mean to write together in an improvisational fashion online with a large group of other writers? Today on Off Center, I'll be talking with digital writing pioneer Rob Wittig about his long career as an experimental writer in digital media and the genre he helped invent, NetProv. Welcome to another episode of Off Center. Today we're here with Rob Wittig, who is sort of the leader of a movement called NetProv, and he's the author of NetProv, Network Improvised Literature for the Classroom and Beyond, and currently a guest researcher with us here at the Center for Digital Narrative. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you, Scott. It's fun to be here.
So today I'd like to talk about NetProv. What is it? What's its history? But also I'd like to talk just a little bit, because you have a sort of unique career in the field of electronic literature that stretches back almost kind of as far as anyone I know, back to the 1980s. So I'm wondering if you can just give us a little bit of an introduction to how you got into this practice that you've engaged in pretty consistently of electronic literature, but and also most often, I'd say, of playing with others in electronic literature.
Well, let's see. I would say from a very young age, I was one of those people always was doing plays, skits, and so on things, and loved the collaborative part of it. And the classic image of that was around in culture of my youth of like the cabin at the edge of a lake and the, you know, getting away to write your novel never appealed to me. It's too lonely. I wanted to be around people and doing collaborative things. And when I more or less accidentally tumbled on the Surrealists in high school and then in college, there was a model of a creative life that I really loved. And at that time, not every American writer was kind of tuned into that. And it was a very genius as brand name kind of literature. And I loved this, the playfulness of the Surrealists and the conviviality and doing things in these collaborative groups.
And writing games were kind of
part
of what they did.
And things to kind of, take that pressure off and allow for fresh new ways of writing and fresh new approaches to life as history was evolving. And it just became clear to me as a young writer that if, you know, I sort of subscribe to, I guess, what's a classic modernist stance, which is that if you write in the forms of a previous time, then you're looking at the present day through a kind of distorted filter or the historic filter, and that new times need new kinds of literature is what I was looking for. Then, you know, after undergrad, I was living in Paris, kind of scraping by teaching English, and wanted to write a volume of poetry, but didn't want to write conventional poetry and was kind of...
I recently got your first novel. What was it called?
The Jolly Place?
The Jolly Place.
Right. Yes. I refer to that as my last novel. That was my last. And it reminds me of, I can't remember who exactly said it, but one of the Oulipo people said, one can never be sure a genre is dead until one has killed it a little oneself. So that's my, again, nothing against other people's novels, but I was not cut out for that. But right after undergrad, I wanted to write a collection of poetry, but I didn't want to use kind of conventional poetic forms. I wanted to try something different. And I had always loved radio. And so I wrote a 61-minute radio plays, each of them trying to be as different in form from the other ones as possible. And that was my way of writing poetry.
What fun. Did you preserve those?
They have lasted to this day. I've got them. I've got them scanned. They're part of the archive that's being built now at the Next, ELO's The Next.
Excellent.
So there's a copy of An Hour, as it's called, that collection. But those experiences prepared me to meet a fascinating group of artists, performers, writers in Seattle who were calling themselves Invisible Seattle. And literally, I found at a coffee house in Seattle a one-off publication called The Daily Zeitgeist that was just full of surrealist references and funny and smart and really interesting. And the group Invisible Seattle was doing performances at the Bumbershoot Festival. And so I went to see them, and they were just people after my own heart. And I worked up the courage and met them. And we started doing collaborative projects over the course of the next few years.
Philip
Wohlstetter is kind of the godfather of Invisible Seattle. He's a brilliant, wonderful American treasure, and a lot of other really interesting people. And the kind of culminating project of that group was the novel of Seattle by Seattle, which started with this idea that how would a book come to be that at a bookstore reading, a bookstore celebration of that book, everyone who came had the right to sign the book. How would you do that? And it was the, you know, early days of Microsoft, and there were people around doing computers. We knew enough about computers to go, it has to involve computers to do something complex like this. So we basically did a crowdsourced novel. We had events, we wore uniforms with a question mark on the hard hat. We called ourselves literary workers. We'd go up to people on the street and say, excuse me, we're building a novel. Can we borrow a few of your words? And we gathered text and kind of put them all into a big pot. And
I remember the line, what's the best place to die in
Seattle? Oh, right. Well, the model question, it's untactful, but it is a model for the kind of questions, where does the guy go to get killed around here? Like that's a way of getting to the cutting through some of the superfluities and getting to the heart of a city. But we would, yeah, one of the best things, interestingly, we learned a ton from that project, but one of the best things that we did was just simply put a diary in branches of the Seattle Public Library and say, write today's entry from your diary. It was the only prompt. And that turned out fantastic material, and it became the diary of one of the characters in the novel. That spirit of putting drafts up on the wall, hanging pens on strings and letting people edit, and just we are all working together to build this novel together.
And I remember the Scheherazade.
Scheherazade too, yeah. The wonderful sculptor Claire Colquitt, who just passed away, sadly, built us a wonderful housing that symbolized a kind of literary computer. Inside were very simple word processors.
Yeah.
And as the actual computer scientists of the time sort of said, slightly rolling their eyes, that we were using Adidas networking, which meant we'd walk across the room with a disc and the public could enter text into repurposed arcade video game machines, but it would just print out on a little roll of paper and then we'd cut it up and hang it on the wall and edit it. But it gave us the sense of how ready people were to write. And people loved it, how people were ready for an opportunity to play. And then also with a kind of literary criticism hat on, if the project of the kind of modern novel is to capture all kinds of voices and a variety of voices, yes, it's a tour de force that a single writer can do, but why not get different voices?
Why not just get everybody to do it?
Why not actually get different voices to capture a city? Because the other impetus for that novel was Philip Wohlstetter just remarking, you know, there's great novels about other cities, but there is no great novel of Seattle. So we're going to ask the city to write its own great novel about itself.
That's fantastic.
So that was published. There is a version that has been published that's still, it's a rare book now, but it is still available. But what we kind of learned from that, I think, that was important, one of the many things we learned, was that with a collaborative piece like that, we declared a version done, one version, but that was only one of an infinite number of possible versions. And it kind of humbled us even in that. It's like, well, we're dealing with a database novel. And that idea of kind of database literature with lots of crowdsourced contributions kind of really caught my imagination for sure.
That idea of a potential literature too, yeah, is a phrase that a lot of people in electronic literature use, and that when you have a database structure, you can have so many different outcomes from a pool of text that can be recombined over and over again differently.
Yeah. So we had done this physical version with lots of carrying boxes of text around, But in the wake of that, the same sculptor, Claire Colquitt, did electronic bulletin board in fall of 83 and into 84. And he used it during the day to share things with computer hacker friends, you know, white hat, good guy, creative hackers, and said, you want to use it at night? We'll just put in another disc and you can use it at night. And so we called it Insomnia, Invisible Seattle's Omnia, and just said, well, we're going to have this dial-up call-in electronic bulletin board. And yeah, I guess we were among the first to do kind of creative projects in that way. You'd have to call with a phone, a computer and a phone, only one person at a time. Exactly. One person at a time you'd leave texts and then you'd sign off and the next person could get on. So we explored kind of in miniature many of the things that people subsequently played with. It was fun. We could use different pseudonyms. So we just would do pseudonyms, have dialogues with ourselves, try to mystify, write things and try to mystify people and who wrote that. And we kind of put it through its paces. We wrote fiction, we read critical theory and talked about it. And then those things got interwoven in a beautiful way.
Yeah, and then you went to Paris and hung out with Derrida.
Yeah, because, well, yeah, it came when we were doing that, it came to our attention that there was this kind of landmark show at the Pompidou Center called Les Immatériaux that was organized by Jean-François Lyotard and Derrida and some others. And they had a bulletin board. And at that time, they were really one of the handful of people that we knew. And we had written about Derrida's work as a play test in a way, like how could this be used for critical thinking, interweaving with fiction. And so I just wrote him and said, hey, I'm wondering if I could have...
What are you doing on Tuesday?
We've done this similar thing. Would you be interested? Could I have a conversation with you? And he was very wonderful, very generous and nice, and wound up sponsoring a Fulbright. And so I did a Fulbright with him. And out of that came the book Invisible Rendezvous, which kind of chronicles those early days. So that's kind of the...
Yeah, great book that came out in 89?
95 was published, I think.
95.
But it's about those earlier days. So that was kind of the background. And then we had been theorizing all throughout the 80s, craving a visual interface. And then the World Wide Web comes along, and it's like, oh, I'm ready. You know, like, we're ready for this. We've kind of been thinking about things that you might do. So we begin to transfer that creativity. The Invisible Seattle Insomnia group finally kind of drifted apart. But in the 90s then, I started doing sort of fictional web pages.
Yeah, in between here, you moved to Chicago and you start working in the field of design.
Working in graphic design. And that's where I met you and... another Center for Digital Narrative investigator, researcher, Joe Tabby.
Well, I remember I should tell the story that we met at Brown for this award that we're both nominated for. And we got to talking and you said, you know, we're both from Chicago and there's a variety of people from Chicago. We should start the Chicago School of Electronic Literature.
That sounds like me.
Yeah.
The thing that really excited me about meeting Scott and his friends with whom he'd done the Unknown Project was, again, here's some of the first people who, like us, knew how fun it was, how fun it is to write together online. Like, it's what people do in text messaging every day now. Like, everybody knows how to do it, but it was pretty rare in those days. And how it can be fun, and some of the gestures that the Unknown did were similar to things that we'd done, but there was a lot of things that I had, you know, just good, new, funny, smart ideas that you and the Unknown people were doing in your piece, kind of both promoting yourselves as writers and then undercutting that promotion and satirizing it alongside, and just really interesting, complex literary strategies and unfolding in real time. So you'd read a text in the Unknown and then all of a sudden there was a new edition or it had been changed by somebody.
William Gillespie, Dirk Stratton, Frank Marcourt and myself. Yeah. One of the things that we would do, we'd post these things on a web server. And there was sort of an idea, well, you maybe you own a scene a little bit, But it was always open to someone else comes in and edits it and changes things and then sort of writes another scene that's sort of counterventing that. It was a lot of fun, a lot of play. And meanwhile, at this time, you were doing something that I think has also kind of been a hallmark of your career, is that you've been looking at these new forms of communication, of web environments, variety of different platforms. And then kind of coming into these platforms that maybe weren't designed for creative play, and then saying, you know, how can I use this to tell a story? Like the Marsha Project.
Yeah. Marsha Project is a sequence of fictional web pages by a sweet woman who wants to have an angel website. And it's very, really web 1.0, little borrowed images and animated GIFs. And
incredibly kitschy.
Very kitschy and kind of all central, you know, everything centered. But, you know, she's good-hearted. And over the course, it's three iterations of the website as one of two things, or maybe both, happen. She invites people, the angels, to come and visit her website. And so either the angels come and they're horrible and they're mean to her, or her site gets hacked. Or I guess the third alternative is that she's slowly having, you know, mental health issues and kind of descending into a mental health crisis. So the website deteriorates, and it's called The Fall of the Site of Marsha, with a thought of a kind of traditions of Gothic literature, because at the time it was a funny idea. Now everybody's seen plenty of them, but then it was a funny idea to think, what does a destroyed website look like?
Or, exactly.
Because everything was all so fresh and new, and, you know, welcome to my homepage.
It might have been her ex-husband. No spoiler.
Exactly. Yeah, right. But it's one of those things. It's a classic, again, the kind of things that a lot of the, like, continued electronic literature is. If you hunt around on the site, you get clues, and you build a story kind of from fragments and clues, and, you know, the unreliable narrator. So she doesn't know quite what's happening, but the reader knows more than she knows. So that was the kind of strategy. Then I did a thing called Friday's Big Meeting, which was about, essentially, you'd say it'd be about Slack or something like that, an early, you know, internal company website of a bad little design company where the boss, for example, doesn't realize that everybody can read every post of his. And so he's constantly kind of embarrassing the company in front of clients. And so that was literally designed as a sitcom. It's got two plot lines. It ran for a week. It was posted in real time every day for a week, but then can be read. And it builds up towards the make or break meeting, the last client on Friday that's going to see whether the company survives, and the meeting of two coworkers who work in different cities and have never met and kind of been flirting with each other, and they're going to meet in person. So Friday's Big Meeting builds up to both of those events.
And of course, then you did, and again, I'm noticing each time it's sort of a different emerging web platform happening. And then your classic Blue Company email novel.
Yeah, so that was a novel. Many of the things that I've done in a way are bouncing off of, in a way, or reacting to theory. So a lot of the early Invisible Seattle things and the collaborations, just sort of the open question in theory of that time is like, what comes after the author? And I had just gotten tired of kind of, you know, big ego, brand name, authorship, and kind of all the old trappings that came with that, and interested in like what other alternatives really would be. Like, can you get people to write together? Can we build something together? So Blue Company was about the fears of the time that actually just make me chuckle. It's like, nobody's going to read and write anymore. Like, nobody with these electronic devices, nobody's going to read.
Electronic literature is like the most hated.
Right. But there were, as a graphic designer, there were problems with it. So I started looking at how I was beginning to write my own emails, which was like poems. I would have a little subhead in bold and then short lines so that they were readable on a scroll. And I would throw in little images and so on. And that was the way I was writing my own emails. So I imagined a fictional situation where it's a marketing guy who's gotten a really bad job transfer. He's been transferred to Italy, which is great, but he's been transferred to the early Renaissance, which is really uncomfortable and dangerous.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's part of a little group of mercenary soldiers who have some mission that he doesn't even quite know what the mission is. And I won't spoil it, but it becomes clear by the end. But I wanted to have, it's the same impulse as having poetry in the form of 1 minute radio plays. Like, I was saying, what happened? What would it be like to have literature in your inbox? And I guesstimated the timing at, like, you can read one of these emails in about 2 minutes or so. So it doesn't take a ton of time. But my mission was to kind of try to get you hooked on the story. And someone's writing you, it's written kind of like an email, but it's a little heightened. And to try to get people interested and hooked and care about the people and then break their hearts. But because, yeah, if you're going to read it, forget that you heard that, but it's everything's fine. But I really love that. And then you picked up without skipping a beat. Scott Repperg picked up and made an answering thing. Maybe you want to describe Kind of Blue.
Oh, yeah. Well, Kind of Blue. Let's see. Yeah. Well, I was really inspired by, and particularly by this thing where you get the email in the middle of your other emails. So I tried to pick up on the story more or less where you left it off, but then also introduce a bunch of other voices, including the person who was sort of deluding that they were in the past. So adding this kind of interrupting layer and also, like you, sort of noticing that people were writing in these different styles of email. So, for example, I remember I was doing a lot of email with Larry McCaffrey at the time, and he did a lot of writing in all caps to sort of, you know, emphasize things and all sorts of strange orthography. And I don't know, it just kind of kept rolling in different directions. And these characters with sort of relatively complicated lives at that point. And I can't even remember how the thing ended.
Well, it's but, yeah.
It, or if it, it did.
Well, ambiguously, but.
Oh, yeah, you also. Yeah.
But no, it was great. And again, for me, it was the kind of experience that I love the best in life. It's like something that feels really new, feeling really interesting. Because I guess, you know, Cervantes wrote his second volume of Don Quixote because someone else had written an unauthorized second volume,
and he
wanted to make some more money while the Quixote craze was hot. So it's not completely.
It was like unauthorized fan fiction.
Right, exactly. But but this idea that, like, in my mind, you know, I was still thinking in a traditional author way. So I did my novel in email and it's done. And it's like, wait a minute, it's not done. Right? When I go to my email now, there's my characters. It's all the same name, but they're all different. And they're all, and it was fantastic. I loved it.
Excellent. Why don't we move now into NetProv? I know there's a lot of other things that happen in between and other writing experiments that happen, but NetProv's a form that comes up. Well, actually, I think you and Mark Marino were here in Bergen, and you guys met and started talking.
NetProv definitely has its origins in Bergen. The quick definition is NetProv is internet improv, you might call it. Networked improvised literature is kind of the formal way of saying it. But it's when you and your friends in your WhatsApp group or take on characters and start kind of role-playing and goofing around. That's just this basic thing that I think the new technologies of communication lend themselves to. And I had done some projects or had conceived of some projects, and Mark Marino had done some wonderful things. And we had that in common. And we started to talk about it and said, let's do more of that. Like, that's what's most interesting to both of us as creative writers. And then a guy named Scott Repperg, who was my advisor as I was doing my master's degree in digital culture at Bergen, said, you got to come up with a name for that. And so, and which was a great favor, a great gift to me. So NetProv has become that. But again, it's important to me that NetProv is not something that Mark and I invented. It's just that we love it. And we decided to start.
Well, you were both doing these sort of collective writing things at the time. And I remember Mark's, he had a Bunk magazine where he'd do these sort of experiments like the Lost Wikilist Times Pedia. which was the premise of that, that was at the Los Angeles Times and had run out of money entirely. So started a Wikipedia newspaper.
and all the worst tendencies of Wikipedia came to the fore.
Exactly.
With hilarious results.
Or the LA Flood Project, which was about voices as LA flooded, but different people contributing. And then a lot of the play, the kinds of structured play with other writers, your projects come into this. So maybe tell us a little bit about some of the early examples. Well, the one you did for your master's project, for example. Yeah.
Well, I can say the one that had been on my mind when Mark and I kind of talked was a thing that I'd still would love to do. So contact me out there if you that's called the Struggling Theater Company. Originally it was the Struggling Theater Company of Chicago, but it could be anywhere. And the idea is that it's the worst little improv group in the world. And during the week, you can read their chat group and all their infighting and love triangles and everything. And then you go see them on Saturday night. For one show a week, you actually see these people who you've been reading. And I love that sense of a story that had an ongoing written real-time kind of social media component, but then also was this moment where there'd be actors doing that. So during the master's degree work here at Bergen, I kind of took that idea. And at the time I was fascinated with the clunkiness of video game avatars. And I remember kind of tromping around my living room, looking over my stepson's shoulder and kind of imitating the clunky running of these characters. And I went like, well, what if you had a service, a company that would kind of more or less secretly offer you a live person in a motion capture suit so that your avatar would move beautifully and naturalistically and smoothly and move better than anybody else's avatar. So as far as I know, still probably totally technically impossible, but that was the notion. And so then it started to grow and became three services, and it became the project called Grace, Wit, and Charm. So Grace is that motion capture service. And we just assumed that it would be applicable to any any game, any VR situation.
Including, as I recall, surgery, right?
Yes, yes, at the end it was medical. And then Wit is if you don't have a great sense of humor and you want to crack up your friends or whoever, then we'll ghostwrite jokes for you. And then Charm was kind of the Cyrano de Bergerac service where we would help you conduct your online romance or long-distance romances. So that's Grace, Wit, and Charm. And the idea was that the Grace, Wit, and Charm has offices all around the world where hardworking appearance enhancement agents would be helping you with your self-presentation on the web. And then they were going to take the Duluth, Minnesota office where I live and for 2 weeks make it public as kind of a promotional thing, but without telling the employees really. It just announces that everything in their chat group is going to be public and that people are going to tune in every Thursday. I think it was Thursday night for an hour and be able to see them. So we arranged with a theater in Duluth to have a place where you could come and see them. And so the text went out on Twitter. It was the Twitter feed of the hashtag of this beleaguered work group, who was not at all happy that their work was being made public. And then you can kind of come and see them. And yeah, the overarching meta story is that given the complexities and difficulties with the American healthcare system, all of a sudden someone seized on Grace, Wit, and Charm as being a way to provide inexpensive health services. And so
distant robot surgery.
Exactly. Yeah. Distant surgery. And so one of the characters, Deb, who had a half a year in veterinary school, she became the medical advisor and so on. Yeah. And then at the second performance, the kind of culmination of the stage performance was we needed to do carpal tunnel surgery on stage. And it took me a long time to figure out how to do it. We just had two people put their hands in a pillowcase. And it all happened inside of a pillowcase. But our actors were wonderful and they were improvisers. And the project I still really love. And it ends with, again, I will spoil this one, but just because I think the ending is still powerful to me. You know, all of a sudden, by the end of the second week, they're doing almost all healthcare stuff. And they're overwhelmed and they're trying to do a good job and they're doing hospice service. And so the final texts of the text stream are somebody helping somebody in their last moments. And so the performance ends and this imaginary patient ends at the same time. So it's, again, I like getting things said.
A little kick in the gut.
Yeah.
Well, tears in the end, right? Yeah.
Mark and I often talk about a kind of a swimming pool shape of our project so that you start off in the shallow end and it's funny. Hopefully it's an appealing netprov concept and it's fun to come and play. And then we kind of drop the depth down and get deep towards the end.
Yeah, and this is a form that has sort of a lot of things feeding in from different parts of the culture that you thought through quite a bit as you developed the idea for this. Maybe just say a little bit about some of those other cultural channels.
Yeah. So Grace, Wind, Charm was one that was more coordinated and planned. But the thing was that the general players, we call them, featured players are kind of the people who are part of the planning and have a bit of a sense of a shape of a netprov. And then the players, the other people who come, and we love them, who come and play, the players in Grace, Wit, and Charm would give assignments. They would pretend to be customers of this company and say, you know, I need someone to attend a meeting for me, or I need someone to attend an online wedding for me. And that was fun to play with. Just like in a improv show, we would take suggestions from the audience and the actors would do a fantastic job with that. But I would say a kind of a typical, an exemplary, simple netprov is 1 week no tech. And this is something you can just do with your friends anytime. You just agree that for 1 week, you're going to pretend to go without digital devices. And then in whatever your social medium of choice is, you just post constantly about how much you miss your phone and how miserable you are and what a pain it is to be without. So it's just a, you know, very simple.
Which is something people do, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That you see when people take these digital fasts and sort of, or at least for a period, that was like a popular thing on social media.
Right, exactly. So that's an idea of a simple one. Some of the more complex ones, an example of a kind of a wonderful poetic one was Monstrous Weather, which we did on the 200th anniversary of the summer, the rainy, rainy summer, rainy because of a volcano that kind of disrupted the climate, where Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley and Byron were all hanging out by Lake Geneva. And that's when Byron essentially invented the vampire craze and Mary Shelley wrote the core of Frankenstein and told it as a ghost story. I wanted to see if we could get people to do ghost stories, but without any of the traditional tropes. There's such a deep literature, but, you know, imagining that no one had ever written a ghost story, what would a contemporary ghost story be about? And would weather, you know, strange weather, changing weather, could that be the kind of catalyst for things? So that sparked just a wonderful summer period of amazing back and forth and poetic things, all kinds of different writing, but centered on that theme.
Yeah, I always think of Jeremy Haidt with, with that project.
Yeah.
He's no longer with us, but he was obsessed with weather, right? And he sort of took weather as a kind of poetic structure and played with that a lot.
It was beautiful. So that's one. Again, in the netprov book that I wrote, there are recipes and examples of these and many more netprovs. And they are, I just think they're something that's wonderful to play with a group of friends. They're literally fun to do as a parlor game, table game with friends. You just take one of these things, you write and giggle. That's just most often what happens. There's a fun period of expectancy where everybody's writing and giggling, then you just share what you wrote and then do another round so you can do it.
You do a lot of these that are just a workshop that's an hour or two and with a prompt and people go with it, but also some that span over the course of months. And I know you said during your presentation that you did here last week, you said that you've done 40.
Yeah, 41, I think, is what currently has made it into the next archives.
But a lot of these have figured into teaching, too.
Yes,
Maybe talk about that, and it's relevant for teaching.
Yeah. They're really good for teaching. Mark and I have been more or less in a rhythm of doing 3 netprovs a year, one each fall and spring, that fit into a semester, and then one in the summer where we have a little more time to play with them, like Monstrous Weather was one of the summer ones. But Mark and I always welcome, we generally have 2 or 3 classes or more at a time all around the world where the students come and play in the netprov together, and we're glad to support that. Mark is excellent about writing teacher materials, kind of behind the scenes pre-writing and teacher materials that are very helpful. So people are encouraged to contact me. And if you want to play along with our netprovs, you're welcome to. And it is a fantastic way to get students to again, step out from under a certain amount of self-pressure and from under the weight of kind of literary styles that they, if they're thinking that they have to write in a certain way. So many of these, it's just like, just write like you write on social media. It's kind of what the writing style is. And then they're just free to play. And
there's often a scenario and there's sort of almost like plot points that you throw at people in the middle of it.
Yes. Yeah. We'll have sometimes, like, again, 1 week, no tech, that just runs for a week and whatever happens. But as in stage improv, the fun of it, and when you become a kind of a net prop player, if that becomes something that you decide, you know, I'm going to spend a little time with this and get good at it, just like in stage improv, you support other people's ideas by imitating them or saying, I'm doing that too, and you build things with people. And there are these passages of play that we really love that we'll call duets or trios, where two people, sometimes it's two friends, but often it's people that from around the world who don't even know each other. They just start to build something together, and then you kind of watch them do something beautiful, and then you can support that, or you can do your own duet that kind of mirrors that.
Playing a character, sort of. Usually yes. Everyone's playing a character that they make up.
Right, exactly. People are role-playing, and as with all kinds of, with all fiction, you know, all your characters are kind of yourself at some level. Yeah. But yeah, that helps, particularly with students, speaking in a character voice gets you out of a lot of the self-pressure. And just like with the email novel, where every day you got a post, and then a couple times I waited a day and tried to, people get people hooked and then miss a day and people going crazy. Did I miss my mate? Did I miss my M? But there's a real-time musicality and rhythm to social media things. And we know that from, you know, all social media works. But it can be a fun period of your life where after work or at lunch, you check the feed and see if someone's responded to what you wrote. And then they have, and then you respond to them. And it becomes this kind of ongoing game that you can play whenever is convenient for you. Although we do encourage people to play at work.
I did my best writing on the unknown. I was working for, I had a summer job at the time. I think it was Amoco corporate headquarters, where they had just hired people. They just basically hired people, I figured out after a couple weeks on the job, to just sort of fill the empty space so that other people wouldn't be depressed. I think I helped write one report, but other than that, it was just sort of sitting around in front of a computer time. It's like the best writing situation I ever had.
That's great. Yeah, it sounds like you were the human equivalent of one of those molded plastic fake TVs at a furniture store.
Exactly. Yeah, well, one thing I wanted to just before we gotta go, because we're already going over time, but a couple things I just wanted to observe and note about NetProv and the way that you guys have done it is, one, there's a critical edge to it in that usually what you guys are doing is taking some aspect of whatever platform, and you've done this in many, many different social media platforms, and you know, ranging from Google Docs to kind of edge social networks, of course, Twitter. But you're also often critiquing those platforms themselves. So that's just one observation I'm going to throw out. And the other is that in spite of what you said early on about sort of abandoning this model of what came before and saying we're going to look for new forms of literature, I often notice that you're sort of hearkening back as well, bringing back like things from the 18th century.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that is true. I mean, that was in the wake of the Invisible Seattle things. That was one of the big turning points in my creative life, was to realize that I needed to stop looking to 19th and 20th century writers for any help in this, because the 19th and 20th centuries is this kind of bookstore, publisher, journal, reviewer model of literature that was falling apart in contemporary times. And that the kind of wide open, lots of scams, lots of unofficial things, that's like 18th century and earlier, that's our home territory. And so I started reading 18th century literary biography and going, oh, these are my people, like Diderot and the encyclopedists. They were graphic designers and they did all kinds of jobs. They weren't a specialized author in the 19th century sense. And it was like, oh, they're like us. Yeah. So I've drawn a lot of inspiration from that. It's the world of digital culture is, to me, is much more like the 18th century than it is the 19th or the 20th.
Well, thanks so much, Rob. I want to mention again that the book that you wrote is called NetProv, networked improvised literature for the classroom and beyond on Amherst University Press. And of course, you can order the paper version, but there's also a free online open access version of the book. If you're just interested, go give it a read and find out more about NetProv. So always a pleasure. And thanks a lot, Rob.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's been fun.
Bye-bye. Today, I've been talking with author Rob Whiting about his amazing career as a digital writer and his work in NetProv. And that's a wrap for season two. This season, we've talked about creative AI, surveillance culture, and machine vision, alternative reality games, transgressive games, and understanding male gamers. We've considered critical software art and speculative design, AI essayism and algorithmic folklore, COVID elit, tactical publishing, and NetProv. We've covered a lot over two seasons and 24 episodes. But we're not done yet. Next season, we'll be back with more episodes of Off Center and some of the pioneering voices of researchers, artists, and writers working with algorithmic narrativity, along with AI updates. To our loyal listeners, thanks for tuning in, and please help spread the word about Off Center. If you enjoy learning about digital narrative, consider sharing Off Center with your friends. And if you teach, share Off Center with your students. Our back catalog is becoming a truly rich archive as we track developments in a rapidly developing digital media ecology. We're doing this to help build a research field in digital narrative and educational opportunities for students, and just because it's also really interesting. After a short summer break, we'll be back in September with more Off Center. Now, can someone direct me to the beach? We all deserve a break and time for some fun in the sun. Have a great summer.
Make sure to follow us on social media by searching your favorite network for the Center for Digital Narrative to keep up to date with our next episodes. You can find us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you for listening. Off Center is produced by Jesse Von Balcombe with the assistance of the design skills of Valeria Antizana Acosta. And we want to thank the Norwegian Research Council's Centers of Research Excellence Program and the University of Bergen for their support.